Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Sammy, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Liso H.
Hi, Liesl Herman, alcoholic. I just want to thank my sponsor for asking me to do this. I didn't even want to come today. I'm having a bad day, and I know. And I don't say no to her. And that's probably the most important thing that I've learned here. It's so funny. I'm so grateful for the life that I have. My sobriety date is February 24th, 1998. And I am from Santa Monica. And I love being home. I did a lot of geographics in my drinking years, and it's been truly a gift to be able to come home to my hometown and be an active participant of my community here, and through, I don't know, some weird things that occurred, I became the scoutmaster of the oldest Boy Scout troop in Santa Monica, and yesterday we were at summer camp where I was supposed to be with 22 eager little scouts until Saturday, and there was a COVID case. And at lunchtime on our first day, they sent us home. So we drove 10 hours to Mendocino on Saturday, and yesterday I drove 10 hours back. And it's pretty devastating to look at a bunch of kids who have been on Zoom for 2 years and have not been able to go camping. If that's your thing, you miss it a lot when you can't do it. And so I've been, like, at home, just really heartbroken and but I checked in with my sponsor who told me I had to come, and then here I am. So, So I grew up in a alcoholic home, like many of us, and I didn't know what was wrong with our family. I was adopted, so I thought that that was why I always felt so different. But that wasn't it. And I also thought it's because I have this ridiculous name. For those of you who don't know, I'm named after this the oldest daughter in The Sound of Music, the one that falls in love with a guy that turns into the Nazi. Yeah, that's the name they chose for me. Right. So my whole childhood, I like was dressed up in like the little Austrian dresses and the whole thing, which is super crazy, especially because I'm Jewish too. So, right. So I had, my parents got divorced when I was 5. They would kidnap us from each other. We had, like, these epic custody battles. It was super crazy, and it was a scary childhood. My mom's the kind of drunk driver who cruises around with her kids in the whatever year, Datsun, and, you know, cruises up onto the curb headed for the bus bench, and people are screaming, and I was the oldest, so I was always in the passenger seat, and, you know, or we'd be walking along, and she'd just fall down, you know, like, what is that? I never really knew what was wrong with her, but it was, so it was an interesting childhood. And then when I was about 11, she had taken off for 6 months with a guy she met in Hawaii and left us with my dad and my brand new stepmother. And she came back in the first, and I was, I just missed her so much. And the first night she was back, they put her on some medication like Librium or something that you're not supposed to drink with. And she drank a bottle of wine and ended up having her stomach pumped. And then they took her away again to Herman Hospital in Houston, Texas, which is very far from Santa Monica. And I didn't see her for another 6 months. And that was the first time I heard about alcoholism and the word alcoholic. And so lucky for me, I ended up being one of those little kids in the back of the room at meetings like this with my coloring book and going to get an ice cream sundae at fellowship afterwards. And, I had a very interesting time in those rooms. And I heard people's stories from when I was really young. And when I was in high school, I was in Alateen. And thank God for Al-Anon family groups and all that they do. I went to my Alateen group all through high school, all 4 years, never missed a Monday night in Santa Barbara. And, most of us are either in these rooms now or dead, but I'm still really close to them. I was really involved in, the Southern California Alateen Convention where we'd all get together. That was super fun when you're 15, hanging out with a bunch of other kids of alcoholics. But I didn't drink a lot in high school. It was also, I'm of an age where Nancy Reagan was the first lady and she had this Just Say No campaign. And we were super involved with that in our Alateen group. And they would ask us to go on panels and stuff. I have no idea what we talked about. But, it did keep me from drinking. But I promise you, when I turned 21, the wheels came off right away. So my birthday is January 7th. My first DUI was like February 21st. And that was the first time people started using the word alcoholic and lethal in the same sentence. And that wasn't cool. But it was certainly not enough to dissuade me. After all, my perfume-drinking alcoholic mother didn't get sober till she was 32. So I figured I had a few more years. I made the most of them. I went to school and I started out as an English major and saw that on Friday afternoons, the geology club had a keg down at the beach in Santa Barbara. And that within the next semester became my major. And I loved it, right? I went on tons of field studies. I've been all over the place, doing really scary, dangerous things, drunk out of my mind. I've gone into lots of abandoned mines and places you shouldn't go. But, I loved it. And, at first I mostly drank beer. And then I started drinking hard alcohol more and more. And my junior year of college, I had an opportunity to do a semester abroad in New Zealand. And I went down there, and my first night, I remember thinking, oh my God, bitter beer, how am I going to survive this? It's terrible. I can't drink it. But I got over that within 24 hours and barely remember much of my semester abroad, except for I met a guy, and I ended up staying in New Zealand for 7 years. The dean of my college called. He was so concerned, because they'd never lost a student before. But yeah, it was something. Anyhow, I ended up marrying that guy, and New Zealand's a really trippy place to live. We ended up buying a farm. I built my own house. It was really, I did all of these things that were super amazing, and the whole time I drank so much, and I hid it from my husband. A cool thing about New Zealand is they have boxed wine, which is not cool here, but in an island nation with an agriculturally based economy, it makes more sense. And you can take the empty bladder out of a box of wine and put another one in there and glue it back together. And by 5 o'clock, no one knows that you drank that whole thing. And so I just descended into really scary alcoholism while I was there. And And then, you know, I came home one year because I wanted to see my grandparents. Back then it was really hard to travel. This was like in the late 80s and early 90s. And while I was here, my husband called me and told me he wanted a divorce. And I was just devastated. But one thing about that was while I was with him, I didn't have any outside issues. But once he was gone, like then everything, oh my God, I can't believe I've been talking like in my drunkalogue this whole time. Everything fell apart. And I ended up getting divorced. I moved back. I was home. And on February 23rd, 1998, I discovered I was pregnant, and I had no idea how that had happened. And I ended up having a baby 3 days after I took my 6-month chip. I'm super grateful today to say that 23, almost 23-year-old has never seen me drunk. And I've seen him drunk. And I already have his sponsor picked out for him. But I have an amazing life today. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to this group and everyone here, my AA sisters, the girls that I sponsor. Thank you for letting me help you and being part of my life. And I just love you all so much. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Gupinder V.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gupinder, and I'm an alcoholic. Just shake off all the nerves. I feel like I'm graduating. So I'm really happy to be here. Mary, thank you so much for asking me to speak tonight as your 10-minute speaker. In addition to, that was such a wonderful talk. Thank you so much. I'm so grateful for my sobriety. I'm so grateful to be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only place that I've ever, ever felt safe. It's the only place that I've ever recovered from that hopeless situation that I was in 8.5 years ago. My sobriety date is February 15th, 2013. Do we have anybody out there? I need to know who got sober in 2013. Anybody? I was going to say, was I the only one? No, I didn't think so. Okay, good. I needed to see that because it sometimes feels that way. And I know that in this very special group, we kind of all really stick together, and that's something that I'm really looking forward to because I'm kind of new to this program of Pacific Group, but not new to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it took me about 8 years of going in and out of rehabs and sober livings and your couch to get sober and clean. You know, I was living off the kindness of strangers for many, many, many years, and that's not the way it was supposed to be. So I was born and raised in England. I moved to the United States in 1989. I was 12 years old when I moved here. I had a very rich English accent. And the more I talk about England, the more the English accent will start coming out. But I do want to share with you that my dad was a mechanic. He worked for Jag. And my mother was, that's Jaguar, okay, if you didn't know what that was. And my mom was a school teacher. She was a teacher. And we had a very kind of very loving, structured family at home. Dad made all the furniture in the house. Mom made all the art and sewed all the clothes for my sisters. All my clothes were ordered from catalogs. We lived outside of town. We lived in a small place called Coventry. And we were Indian. Obviously, I'm still Indian, but we're Indian. And it was Indian food every single night except for Fridays. It was fish and chips. So that was my childhood. Just kidding. And then, you know, everything was really grand. I was a very, 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 very kept kid because I was one boy out of four children. I had three sisters. I had two older and one younger. And I was very, very close to my mom and dad. And things were really, really great. And, you know, until I turned 9 years old, I lost my mother and my grandmother in a tragic car accident. And then shortly right after that, my dad took us to America. He brought us here to LA. And he said, we're going to Disneyland, because it was so rough, you know, being a kid and losing a parent at that age. And while he was here, he met a woman and they fell in love. And all of a sudden, we started the immigration process. And we moved here in 1990. And I've been here ever since. And never knew it was going to end up being this way. But it was very difficult for me going through adolescence, because I now had two additional sisters. So I had, we were like the Indian Brady Bunch, with six kids in our family. So five girls and one boy. And that was very, very difficult for me, because this woman was not my mom. And my dad had no time for me anymore. And all I had to do was kind of like adjust to his lifestyle here. It was a big culture shock for a kid like me on so many different levels. When I moved to the States, I had really long hair. I had a turban. And the kids here just didn't know what to do with me. They were just so confused, because I'd walk into a class and I had this really big English accent and I had this turban, and they just didn't know what to make of me at all. So that was immediately I knew I was very different. You know, that was where it all started for me. And then all after that, it was all about just fitting in. So fast forwarding, getting into high school, still had an English accent, so I figured I could take drama class and do really well in Shakespeare, and I did. And I met all the other drunks and alcoholics in high school, of course. You know, the drama kids are kind of wild. And I got into all the plays, and I got into musical theater, and I had arrived. I met all my friends, and we started celebrating after those shows, and those shows went on into the weekends, and those weekends went on into rave parties. And those rave parties ended up, you know, as you can only imagine, doing all different kinds of other substances besides alcohol. And, you know, that door had been kicked wide open for me for many, many years. And eventually and tragically, things went on and my disease progressed. And my relationship with my parents, of course, was dwindling and getting further and further away. And I was, you know, at one time very close to my sisters. And there had been a time where I hadn't seen my sisters in a couple of years at a time, all through adolescence. I mean, so go figure. I started using and drinking when I was 16 years old, and I got sober at 35. So if you're 35, that's a really good age to get sober. You know, I think any age is a really good age to get sober. I had my sponsor at the time said, Gurpinder, you know, it's a really, really great time for you to get sober, because you can really make something really great of yourself. And so I was finally at my final last treatment center, and I had completely and utterly surrendered to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been here ever since. I'm so grateful to this program. I'm so grateful to the steps. I'm so grateful to the people that came before me and all the men that kind of carried me through, not only when I was in and out, but when I finally decided to put it all down and just kind of move forward, you know. I'm going to talk about a higher power and talk about God really quickly, because that was like the biggest game changer for me in sobriety. If anybody out there is having any difficulty with this thing, my experience completely changed. And that's what I'm here to tell you about, is my experience. So I'm going to tell you is that my experience in AA completely changed. My whole entire life changed when I began to get on my knees in the morning and start praying to a loving God. Even if I didn't feel like a God was there or a higher power was there, I just did it because that's what they told me to do in this program. And things started to happen for me. Things really, really started to change. And, you know, through all the life's trivials and all the things that I've been going through for the last couple of years, because it's been a really wonderful, wonderful journey in sobriety. I have to tell you, at 5 years and at 40 years of age, I got married. And never, ever thought that was going to ever happen for me the way that it did. And that would never have happened if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you that all my sisters and my parents were at my wedding, and they were all doing, I mean, I was so surprised when we had like sat down and like did the toast and everything. My sisters broke out into like Bollywood song and dance. And that was like, it was like the Twilight Zone had happened. Like, how did this happen? And my sponsor came over to me at the time and said, you know, you really need to remember this moment, because you've come full circle. You know, that's one of the things that I'm so utterly and truly grateful for in this program is that I've changed now. I've turned into somebody else. Now the disease can still be there, but I bring myself to an AA meeting. I do call my sponsor regularly. I do reach out to other alcoholics. I try to be of service as much as possible. I do try to keep my nose in the book. I try to be of service to my parents because they're starting to get a little bit older now. That's a really nice thing. It's such a warm thing to kind of have my parents call me and ask me to come around. Because before it was just like, we don't know what to do with you. You know, we don't even know how to deal with whatever it is that you're going through. So please just go and figure it out and sort it out. And I think that happens to a lot of people and they just don't make it back. I'm grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program to where I've been able to come and learn how to become an adult, you know, and to be of service. And so if anybody out there, anybody that's super new or coming back or returning, just know that, you know, this program is absolutely for you if you're considering this program. If you are an alcoholic or if you've decided that you're going to like let it all go and try something different, I totally encourage you to accept this program because there's so much more to life now that I have to look forward to and that I can be grateful for because of this program. So thanks so much.
Our main speaker tonight is Mike S.
Hi, my name is Mike S. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. It's good to be sober. Thank you, Mary, for inviting me to come back to the Pacific Group. It's always something. I'm not real sure why until after. I also wanted to thank you for having two 10-minute speakers whose names I cannot pronounce. I take everything personally, and I believe that going way back to when they were children, their parents gave them those names so I wouldn't know them. But I'll do my best to try to think. It's either Goopender or Zoolander. I'm also hard of hearing. I think it's Goopender. But I did think he said Zoolander at first. It's a nice name. It's a good name for a movie. And Liesl, thank you for sharing tonight. I got a lot out of both of their talks. But one thing about Liesl's talk that surprised me is when she said she was pregnant but didn't know how that happened. Will someone tell her before the night's over? Because it could happen again. I mean, it could. And then she'd go, oh, my God, look, again. Here I am. I was sorry to hear about the Boy Scout camp out. No, I wasn't. You know, I was really wild. But I know those kind of things are hard. I've known a lot of you for a lot of years, and I appreciate being back at your group. But, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately about myself, which is a subject I think about all the time, is I have spent my whole life being ruled by my emotions. My entire life has been based on any feeling that I happen to have at the moment. And one of the things that's kept me in conflict in the world, in addition to my drinking, but along with it, and I'll get into some tie into that in a minute, is this. If I have a feeling, it's an urgency. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not like you might have a normal feeling. I would imagine some people, probably not here, but in other rooms would have a feeling and then be able to say to themselves, you know, if I still feel this way tomorrow, I'll deal with it. If I have it, I have to deal with it as I'm having it. Do you know what I'm saying? Because without it, there's some kind of panic that sets up in me. And it's been a problem all of my life. And one of the things that I've gotten so much from the Pacific Group is this. You have strong sponsorship lines and families. You have people who actually suggest and or tell you how to behave in the world. And I have appreciated that. I've had a good life sober, and I'll get into some of it in just a minute. But I know for certain, and I don't want to forget saying this, that the reason I have that is because I have had men sponsor me who were strong enough to listen to me and to listen to my perceived or real problems and give me direction without the same emotional attachment I have to everything I do. People who have been able to tell me, sit still. One of the strongest gifts I've ever been given, and one of the hardest things still for me to do today as an old man is this. Leave it alone. Huh? Leave it alone. See if you still feel this way tomorrow. But tomorrow seems like an eternity when I have a thought. Huh? I won't be able to sleep again until I solve the problem. Which brings me to this. I've been sober since May the 30th, 1980. It's been a long time that I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I owe my sobriety, obviously, to the 12 Steps and to Bill Wilson and Alcoholics Anonymous, and specifically to this group because my sponsorship line came out of here. It came out of here at the very beginning. I didn't know it was going to come from here. I didn't even know anything about the Pacific Group. I grew up in an alcoholic home. There's a shock, huh? And my father owned bars and ran nightclubs. And I had developed an idea when I was young about drinking. My father was alcoholic, but he wasn't a mean alcoholic. He was a fun kind of alcoholic, at least to me as a child. Now, my mother had other evidence that that may not be true. Huh? But as a child, it seemed to me it was real clear that he was having fun. He had this little bar that he owned at one time in our lives. And it was the kind of joint that when you walked into it, it just felt, even as a little kid, good to me. It was dark. It was air-conditioned. They had different kind of games to play. It was kind of like a church. Do you know what I'm saying? It was just, there was something comforting about it. And the people that were in it were the characters that that most probably good people wouldn't appreciate as much as we did. Huh? My father and his friends were gamblers, and they were womanizers, and they were the kind of men that I admired terribly. And he was seemed to me to be a happy man, especially when he was around his buddies. They hung out, they went to the racetrack, they laughed, they did a bunch of good stuff. And on the other hand, and Lexi's here tonight, she knew my parents. On the other hand, there was my poor little mother who'd grown up in an alcoholic home, not too far from Kansas City, by the way. And in her home, her grandfather was the alcoholic and the town drunk, and he brought a lot of shame to their family. They took it in as real shame. I mean, genetically, we have passed along shame to each generation. Huh? It's in there somewhere. But she never drank in her entire life, and yet she married a barman, a man who was going to bring our family through all the kind of things that a bad drinking man does. Through all the hardships, she was always there to take care of it. She was like the mother. You know what I'm saying? She was always there to get him out of a scrape, to make sure that we were okay. And we moved frequently, which was a good thing for him and me and everybody else in the family. You know, my parents loved me to pieces. They loved me almost too much. There never is too much, by the way. I was looking back at my life a while back, and I was thinking about the ladies I've been involved with. And for a lot of times, I would think to myself, they just don't love me enough. If they just loved me more, I would be okay. But the truth of the matter is this, they loved me as much as a person could be loved. I just can't feel it. No matter how much attention or love you give me, it is not enough to fix what's wrong with me inside. Because there's something wrong on an emotional level that doesn't get fixed by the things that I think gets fixed by. I suffer from lots of delusions. And one of them is real simply this, that I think I know what it is that's going to make me happy. I have believed that all of my life, and I've been wrong all of my life. If the contrary were true, if I really knew what it was that was going to finally bring me the kind of comfort I think I need, it would have happened by now. You know what I'm saying? It would be done by now. Something would have worked. But instead, I have these feelings, these emotions that torture me, and I look for something outside of me to make it okay. I often say it like this. I can tell at the end of any given month how well I've been doing emotionally by how many Amazon Prime packages I've received in the mail, you know? Because during a bad time, I have to have some kind of distraction outside of me, whether it's a new, name it, whether it was a relationship, whether it's a simple little package from Amazon. At least for a moment, I'm not thinking about myself. Because part of at least my condition, and I think it's alcoholism, but I'll just leave it alone as my condition for the moment, is I suffer from torturous self-consciousness, an unsparing feeling and concern about what you think of me or what I think about myself. I used to worry, and still do for quite a bit, about how I'm being judged, but something else occurred to me as I got older, and that's this. I judge myself worse than you can ever judge me. I beat myself up more than you can ever beat me up. When I was 13 years old, we moved out to California, and I had a pretty good life started. I was at this all-boys Catholic high school. It was a fun place for me. By my senior year, I had relaxed enough to have a lot of friends there. I surfed in those days. I was at the beach a lot. I was in good shape. I was still not bad looking. I wasn't in a relationship yet, so I was still happy. Life was going along. Life was going along pretty well. And I started to drink my last week or two of my senior year in high school. And all I can tell you about my drinking is this. I'm a bad drinker. I never felt bad about being a bad drinker. I drink horribly. If you were somewhere in my drinking days and there was alcohol present, you never had to ask, has he been drinking? You know what I'm saying? I not only slur my words, I look slurred. I act slurred. I have emotions that will change in a heartbeat and then come back around. Just as you're getting used to one emotion, it's the next one. I drank in a blackout the first day I drank, and I drank in a blackout for the next 14 years till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in the big book, Dr. Silkworth, and everybody in here knows it, talks about the fact that part of the disease of alcoholism is a craving, the phenomenon of craving, he called it. And I remember hearing that term and talking about cravings, and I'm thinking, I don't know that I ever craved alcohol. Well, there may be two reasons why I didn't recognize it. The first one was I never did without, so there was really no time to crave it very, very long anyway. But secondly, my cravings, when I did have them, disguise themselves. They come across as a thought, as a new plan, as a new idea, not as this maniacal urge to drink again, but just this feeling like, you know, it's going to be okay, I can drink. But I never drank well. I've never heard anybody say, when I was growing up and drinking, especially with my younger buddies and stuff when we first started, why don't you drink like Mike? No parent ever said, hey, I don't recall after a party or a get-together anybody ever saying, you know, you really handled yourself well last night. It wasn't going to happen, but it didn't bother me. The worst part was I had developed this idea that the only thing wrong with bad drinking, after watching my parents, the only thing wrong with bad drinking was other people's reaction to it. If people wouldn't complain, like my mother, then the real fun people would have a good time. It would be a nice, if she would just get off his back. And I believed that and took it with me through too many relationships and too many places and too much hurt. I don't recall ever waking up in the morning thinking, I really want to hurt some people today. I really want to make somebody so sad that they cry. I don't want to hurt them. I never planned that. I think one of the cruelest things that happens to somebody with my kind of emotions is I get the incorrect idea that I have to know the answer to things, that I have to know what to do next, that I have to know exactly what to do with no mistake either. God forbid if I make a mistake. Because if I make a mistake, something bad is going to happen. I don't know what it is. But I know what's going to happen. And so I have spent most of my life trying to figure out a way just to be all right, just to be okay, just to get by. When I started drinking, I only had a few problems. 14 years later, I had major difficulties. Silkworth talks about that too in the doctor's opinion, that he worked with patients that had so many, that their problems had piled up so high, the problems were astonishingly difficult to solve. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1980, my problems were monstrously hard. There was no solving them. How do you solve the fact you left your wife and two children one day while they were at the grocery store? With a little note saying, I'll be back sometime. You don't solve that. Not really. Not in the sense I thought about solving. How do you solve the fact that you've been arrested and had some little stupid convictions that are harming your life and things that are going on? How do you make up for all the bad, violent nights that a person like me finally gets into? There's no solving it. And so here's what finally happened to me. In late 1979, if anything outside of me was ever going to fix me, it should have been that year. I was on my second marriage. Lucky you knew her too. A nice lady. She had the looks I thought I needed. Because that, if I had to make a list of what I need in a wife, it's looks, and then that's it. I'm done with my list. I'm not shallow, I just don't have a lot of depth. You know what I'm saying? I'm living in this nice two-story white Cape Cod house with a white picket fence, driving my Mercedes, making more money than I was going to make for many years in sobriety, and suicidal almost every day. You know, people often say in AA, and I accept that it's the truth for them, that alcohol quit working for them. It did not quit working for me, not in one major sense, not in the key essential sense for someone like me. What alcohol was always able to do, there were a lot of things, but one of the major ones was this. I could walk into a bar with tons of guilt on my mind, reliving every major mistake or minor one that I'd ever made, worried about what I was going to do in the future, worried about how was I ever going to get out of this mess or make a living or whatever the topic happened to be at the moment. When I sat down with you at a bar and started to have a beer, all of a sudden, I didn't care anymore. I was doing what we try to teach each other to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in the now. I'm at the bar and I don't care about the rest of it. I'll deal with it later. And if I could have stayed in those few minutes or that hour or whatever it was where I felt like that, it would have been great. But of course, that wasn't happening. Because during the course of those drunks, every one of them, there was some kind of ugly scene, some kind of misbehavior. Because alcohol also is able to dissolve my moral conscience. Alcohol's able to take any kind of thought I have about being good and push it aside in favor of having fun. I liked that about alcohol. It was a pleasure drug for me, and it made it easier to live. It's easier to sit in an air-conditioned bar and drink with my buddies than to go to work. It's easier to sit in there than to go home. Life just got worse and worse and worse, but I was so miserable, and I had no connection in my mind that it had anything to do with bad drinking. I saw myself having two major categories of problems. One was bad drinking. Maybe alcoholism, although I knew nothing about it, and then a lot of problems. But I didn't make the connection. Now, there's some that are there. If you get arrested and you have to pay a fine, then obviously that for driving under the influence or something, that's clear. But how about just being miserably unhappy? How about just never having a time where I'm free from thinking about some way to fix my own world? It's punishing. It's horrible. On May the 30th, I woke up. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. It was June gloom was in. I was sleeping on my friend's couch because I'd spent the night over there drinking. I'm allergic to cats. He had a white cat. It slept on my head. I was swollen, had white animal hair over my face. I had a bad hangover. I drove down to the Del Taco and got a chocolate milkshake for breakfast. You need nutrition. And then I took a little Black Beauty for some energy because I liked energy. And I went and bought two tall cans of Coors. And I started to nurse one, and I had a feeling come over me that can come over me in sobriety. I think it's sadness and loneliness, but I don't know if I really have the words. But what it felt like was this. It was like I was in the world, and there was this big, thick plate glass piece in front of me and everything else. I saw the world, but I wasn't in it. I couldn't decide where to go that morning. I could have gone home, for God's sakes, huh? I could have gone to work. I could have gone a lot of places, but I was just in the depths of absolute despair and depression. It was a horrible morning. I'd gone to a meeting. Right before that, people started suggesting that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, it's one thing, like, if a therapist suggests it, like a psychologist or a doctor, somebody like that. But I had people in bars suggesting it, you know, and that's another small piece of evidence that perhaps something is wrong. I have always been shy. I got worse the more I drank in terms of public speaking or meeting people in public or doing anything like that. I'm the kind of guy that at a bingo game wouldn't yell out bingo, you know, even if I had it, right? Fearful that there was no 068. It was just like, oh, my God. I stayed at school one time in college. I went to a class, finished the whole semester. In the last 2 weeks, the professor said, you don't have to do those term papers we talked about if you just give a 10-minute speech. I took an F for the class rather than risk looking bad. Because by then, I couldn't make a public mistake because I'm so scared of what you think. I don't know that. I just think I'm too cool to do it. But that just was just a nonsense. And I went into this little meeting, and it turned out it was a discussion meeting, and the guy had a gavel like this, and he would rap it on the table and call on people to speak. And I was terrorized. And so I pretended to be asleep during the meeting, and I looked at my shoe. I did anything not to make eye contact with that guy. But I often suffer from conflicting simultaneous emotions. And as soon as he didn't call me, my feelings were hurt. I hated the guy. Then they held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, and I was embarrassed. Felt dirty. I felt like I needed a shower after that. And I went home and told my poor, suffering wife that when she asked me, what do you think? I said, it's terrible, for God's sakes. It's humiliating that adults have to act like that, that they have to be somewhere like that. You know, I heard a guy when I was about a year or two sober take his first year cake. He was behind me in sobriety at other little meetings. And he said he went to his first meeting and had those same uncomfortable kind of feelings. Didn't like AA, but he was like an AA genius. When he went home and his wife asked him, what do you think? He told her he thought it would help. Him, her, the dog, everybody. I mean, it wouldn't, the neighbors, I don't know who. Everybody wouldn't stop. But he said there was only one problem with it out there in Riverside. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous was such a popular organization, it was full. There was no more room. And he didn't stop with that. He said he was on a waiting list. And they told him if he drank on the waiting list, she wasn't supposed to get mad. I thought he was a genius. It was like, oh, my God. And I don't mind passing that along if you need it tonight. Because here's my belief. When it was my time to get sober, it was my time to get sober. Whether I understood anything, whether I had any kind of desire, really. If you said to me at the beginning, do you really want to stop drinking? The answer was no. No, I don't want to stop. Because you know what that means? It means giving up that little bit of peace of mind I do have. It means giving up hanging out in the bars and doing the chasing and running the way I did. I didn't want to give any of that up. But here's what happened. That morning when I was feeling so bad, I went back to where they had that meeting. I checked myself in, and it was a 3-week program. And I did not want sobriety, but I wanted away from my life for a few weeks. I was going to get it. I had a plan. I was going to get a divorce, move to Newport Beach, California, and quit selling real estate, because that was the problem. That was the real problem in my mind. And I'm in there, and I enjoyed it. We went to meetings. I liked seeing the pretty girls. I liked funny speakers. But I wasn't going to do anything about it. I just enjoyed it. My last Sunday night in there, I had 2 more days to go. I was watching TV when they said it was time for the H&I panel to come talk to us, which provoked anger in me. I didn't want to quit watching TV. And when I walked in, it was one man, one little white-haired man, nondescript, looked like me now, huh? And he's up at a table alone. And so I pointed out to the other patients, that's not a panel. You have to have 2 or more people to have a panel. And they're saying things to me like, shut up, just be quiet. And I'm daydreaming about my divorce, and the panel's blabbing, and I'm daydreaming. And he says, you want to know what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, no. And I'd been to 7 meetings, for God's sake. I knew what he found. He found God. I'm not looking. He made friends. I have friends. He found an AA potluck somewhere. Oh, good. I'll bring the potato chips. And he said it a second time. You want to know what I found here? And I'm thinking, no, I don't want to know. Nobody wants it. Nobody cares what you found here. And then to make it worse, he said, I'm going to tell you. So I'm so mad that my mind shut up for a minute. And here's what he said. He said, I found a higher degree of mental comfortableness. I have peace of mind. I'd never had peace of mind. My friends and I were better looking. We drove better cars, I'm sure. We had better girlfriends, I'm positive. But he said something that made my mind be quiet for about 3 or 4 minutes. He said he was going to go home to a wife that he loved. He was going to get up in the morning and fix his lunch in his lunch pail, have breakfast with his children because he wanted to, go to work and give him 8 hours of work for 8 hours of pay, come home and have dinner with his family and go to a meeting, smoke cigarettes and drink coffee, and that he'd never had it so good. What did he describe? Serenity. The result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The result of trying to reduce his own ego enough to fit somewhere without being tortured or having to know the answers to every problem on earth. He stunned me so much that I went back to my room that night in that little place and read the big book for the first time by myself. And to this day, Bill Wilson's writings have a soothing effect on me. They don't make it perfect, but they have a soothing effect. That week or a week after, I asked a man to sponsor me. I didn't know he'd come out of this group named Don, who'd moved out to Riverside. At the same time, a guy named Jim Hamza had moved out. They came out together, and they were working at a Mercedes store out there. I thought Don was rich, so I asked him to sponsor me. And he went bankrupt that year and lost his car. That's how I got a job. You know, I try to run my life all the time, but in reality, when I think about it, I can't even decide what lane of the freeway to get in. You know what I'm saying? Whatever lane I pick seems to go slower instantly. And so, and yet I will spend an inordinate amount of time trying. And Don made me start taking the actions you teach here at the Pacific Group, actions better than the way I think and feel. I was terrified at meetings, and he made me go around and meet people I didn't know. I was so sick to my stomach to have to do that. I just hated it. He made me get a commitment at the meetings and be there. And here's what ended up happening for me. My whole life, he told me I couldn't get a divorce, change jobs, or move. That was my whole life's plan. And at the end of the first year, I was doing okay, but I was going backwards financially, quite a ways backwards. I was paying the IRS, the Mercedes was gone, I'm driving a flesh-colored Ford, that's always a cool car, and I started applying for positions that were up to my standard, and I didn't get the jobs. There's a shock. I almost did. But Don also took me to hear Chuck Chamberlain speak all the time, Johnny's papa. And he fascinated me. He was the first human being I heard talk about believing that God actually did things in his life if he surrendered. He talked about his belief that God really took care of us. I wanted to believe it was true, but I didn't believe it. There's no requirement to believe it to try it, is there? There wasn't for me. There was no requirement for me to understand that to the extent I surrender, even if that comes after pushing and pushing and pushing and finally surrender, that unbelievable things can happen. And I don't mean just the things I wanted. Because some of the best things that have ever happened to me in the 41 years I've been sober are the things that seem the worst. You see, I don't know what part of the play is going on when I'm pissed off that X just happened. I got this one offer for a job in Orange County. I was grateful for about 5 minutes that I got the job. I was grateful till my first day of work is what it was. And I called Don, said, I'm leaving. And he said, no, you're not. People like you are quitters. You're going to stay there 1 year. And this is a short talk meeting, so I'm going to keep it real short. But I did what he said, and I was scared going to work. I didn't know those people. I didn't walk in and somebody goes, hey, I'm in AA too. It didn't happen. I walked in and I was terrified. But you know, that year came and went, and I ended up staying there. I liked being there. And a lot of you I've known for a long time. I One of the side effects to that job was there was a law school in the area that I was assigned to work in, and I started going to law school at nights and on weekends. And I immediately wanted to quit. And he told me, you know what, can't you finish anything? And I said, no, I can't. I really can't. And he said, nobody cares if you become a lawyer, for God's sakes. Finish the class. And we did that for 3.5 years. And I stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on my sixth AA anniversary, on that day I got the results in the mail that I'd passed the bar and became an attorney. It was the perfect job for me because it seemed through a series of things that shouldn't have happened that I got hired as a district attorney. Huh? I'm terrified to speak in public, and that's all they do is do trials. But it was a great job. And it turned out I had a talent for doing it, and I became chief of homicide and stayed in that position for a lot of years. It was perfect for me. And I sometimes joke about it. I'll say, you know what? Why didn't you just tell me it was going to work out perfectly? But that's what we tell each other every meeting, and we always say it. We tell each other every single night, just let go, sit still. It'll be okay. It's going to work out. Now, by work out, I don't mean it's going to come out to my definition of what I thought it ought to be. Because I shortchanged myself many, many times. Now, having said that to you, it seems to me that I ought to know better than to still fall back into my old ways of being fearful or doubtful when I see something wrong, but I can't. I have some days when I don't have the faith of anything. Not even a mustard seed, huh? Nothing. And that's when I rely on you. That's when I rely on trying to do things for other people, not because I'm in any great place, but because you told me to do that. The Pacific Group, at least to those of us who aren't regular members here, taught and sent out your missionaries, I guess, to outlying areas, who pushed the fact that it's the actions of sobriety. It isn't the thinking. It isn't the figuring out. It isn't coming up with my own solution. I have ideas and wants and needs and those kind of things. Don't get me wrong. But one of the biggest gifts you give me from the podium is this, not being a phony. I need to know if there are some days when you don't feel so good. I need to know if there's been some times in your sobriety when it wasn't working. We had a speaker at our group last week, and she said something I thought was an excellent thing to hear from me again. She said she was going through a bad time with a divorce and some other kind of things in her life. And she said that she called her sponsor and was saying it's not working. And the sponsor said, but you would think to say, but I wouldn't have thought it. She said, are you drinking? And the lady said, no, I'm not drinking. She goes, then it is working. Huh. When I was 90 days sober, I was out of town down at Oceanside staying at the beach. And the urge to drink hit me for real. Not just a thought. Not maybe it would be good, but I nursed the thought all day long till I was nearly sick to my stomach. I wanted a beer. I could taste the beer. I could feel that glass with the ice on the outside. I mean, I was mad. I get mad all the time, so I was really mad that day. And I went in the house. I'd been out in the water, came in and got my street clothes on. I was going to go buy a six-pack. And instead, I did what I must have heard somebody say or suggest something similar. I got on my knees, and I asked a higher power, who I did not believe in would really work in our lives, to help me. And when I got up, the urge to drink was gone and has never, ever come back to me again. Ever. I was uneasy. That's what I think AA does for people like me who really cannot stop drinking on their own. If I try to stay in the program and work it and have some kind of relationship with a higher power, and my ideas of a higher power change over the years, I have other experiences but I'll die not really knowing what God is. Huh? Not really. I have some pretty strong beliefs. For instance, I don't believe God does anything bad to people to teach them lessons. Not at all. I've got a friend named Barbara that says it as well as anybody I've ever heard. She talked about the fact she had been to the doctor and was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And she went to her women's meeting that night and was saying, I don't know where God is. Where's God? And one of the ladies, her sponsor, I believe it was, came up to her afterward and said, you know, Barbara, God was just as unhappy when he heard that news as you were. He'll be there with you to help you get through it. What I've been promised in AA isn't that everything will work out the way I want it, but I am promised everything will work out, and it does. It really does. I just don't trust. A lot of you remember Father Martin was around for a long time, and he used to tell the story about the man walking at night in the dark, and he falls off the edge of a cliff, and he's fallen and fallen and fallen, and he reaches out and he grabs hold of a branch, and he's terrified, and he yells up, "God, if you're up there, help me." And God says, "Let go of the branch." And the man hangs there another second and yells, "Anybody else up there?" And the story ends that it's morning and sunlight comes up and he's only a foot off the ground. If he'd have let go at any time, he'd have been fine. In the big book, there's a line that said we had to quit playing God. I never believed I was playing God because the religion I grew up in didn't have a God that actually did daily things for people. The God I was raised on was supposedly loving, and I guess so. But he waited for either me to either be good in life or bad in life, and then I would get whatever was coming to me one way or the other. The God you all started talking about was a God that just wanted me to be happy, joyous, and free. I've changed the happy, joyous, and free for me just slightly. I want to be content. I want to be okay whether you give me the attention I need at the moment, whether I get any kind of recognition or not. I want my ego to be in enough, the right size enough, that I'm just content with the way my life is right now without having to change it. I've got a guy sponsor, he told me this year, he said, "You know, if I could just lose some weight and my hair were darker again, I'd be happy." I told him, I said, "You know, I knew you when you were thinner and had dark hair, and you weren't happy then either." But I understand that thinking because I do it. It's like if I could just, and I'm not saying there aren't bad things that happen. Being the business I was in, I'm not saying that at all. There are terrible things that happen. There are sad, horrible things. When you lost Clancy last year, it was a huge hit. But I bet God's glad he's got him. And what he taught you all, you represent so well. I mean, you really do. There's a certain presence in people that work the program out of these kind of groups that were so influenced so well. I come to meetings to get what I cannot give myself, and that's hope. Because I slip into despair way too often over almost nothing. I'll tell you one quick story and I'm done. Your group has always been kind to me. Not kind enough, but very kind to me. And in 1985, somehow I'd gotten tickets to go up to the Montreal Convention, the International AA Convention, with the Pacific Group people. And the best I remember that, there were two airplanes, and Johnny was on one, kind of the leader of that one, and a lot of big-time AA speakers, huh? And I don't know who was on the other plane, but I was on Johnny's plane. And people were nice and kind to me. We flew into Burlington, Vermont, and it was near the 4th of July, and we were staying at a hotel. And they announced there would be an AA meeting in this big room there. We went into it, and they said, "We're going to have a meeting tonight. We're going to ask two of you to speak." And I thought, "I don't want to speak tonight." That's how obsessed I am with myself and how fearful. Then they didn't ask me. But I was. I watched you do what you did. I believed your lives were better than mine. I don't have to believe the philosophy behind anything, but I can see the evidence in people's daily lives. They handle hard things. I don't want to have such an image that I can't tell you the truth. Because if I'm the only person in AA feeling bad, then I probably don't belong here either. I need to know if other alcoholics sometimes have horrible times, and I appreciate the honesty when it's shared that way. Thanks for letting me share tonight.
for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and you'd like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. And if you're taking a cake tonight, people who have lined up here, we have lots of birthdays tonight. So if you're taking a cake online, you have to email Kimberly K at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon Wednesday deadline. Hybrid birthdays will be shown after the in-person birthdays. Now we have to sing briskly and speak briefly. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. So our first birthday is for 1 year for Rachel.
Hi, everybody. Rachel Alcoholic. I would like to thank God, my sponsor Piper, Pacific Group, and Clancy for the structure. Thank you all.
Our second birthday is for Stephanie S.
Hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank my sponsor, Georgia, my sober sibling, Greta, Lindsay, Hilda, and Sharon. Thank you so much.
Our next birthday is for 2 years for John B.
John Alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor, Marty, and Pacific Group and AA as a whole. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for Marquita W. All right, and Rhonda, is getting her cake.
Marquita, alcoholic. I want and have to thank God and my sponsor, Rhonda Daly, and all of you. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 5 years for Steve W.
My name is Steve Whitmore, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Charlie. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank God. I want to thank Paula, and certainly thank all of you.
Our next birthday is for 7 years for Bobby Joe A.
Bobby Joe, alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for allowing me to take this cake. I would like to thank my amazing sponsor, Yvonne, my sobriety sisters, all my friends, God, and Clancy for the structure.
Our next birthday is for 9 years for Joe E.
Joe Alcoholic. I'd like to thank Marty, my sponsor, and God, and all of you, of course.
Our next birthday is for 19 years for Guy B.
Guy Alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor, Marty, the man I sponsor, the Pacific Group, and Alcoholics Anonymous.
Our next birthday is for 22 years for Sochi NV.
Hi, Sochi Alcoholic. I'm grateful for the grace of God, for the wonderful direction of my sponsor, Quincy, my sober family, and the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 25 years for Bill K.
My name is Bill Knox. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to first thank my higher power for the gift of 25 years of sobriety. I want to thank my sponsor for 30 years of love and service. I want to thank Clancy for the structure of the group. I want to thank my AA brothers for always supporting me and always being there for me. And I want to thank the Pacific Group as a whole.
Our next birthday is for a former secretary of the Pacific Group for 28 years, Hilda F.
My name is Hilda. I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank Sharon for her amazing example, my sobriety sisters, the women I sponsor, the women they sponsor, my wife Julie for 26 and a half years of happy, healthy relationship, I guess. My best bud, Nancy C., and my home group, the Pacific Group. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 29 years for Randy M.
My name is Randy Miller. I'm an alcoholic, and I'd like to thank Tom for all 29 years. I'd like to thank my AA brothers. I'd especially like to thank Clancy for the structure of the group. It's something special. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 31 years for Ron St. J.
Ron St. John, alcoholics. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Tom Bessard, all my brothers, Clancy for our group, my wife, Julie, and the class of 090.
Okay. Our next birthday is also for 31 years for Michael B.
Michael Blanc, alcoholic. I want to thank God for getting me here and keeping me here. Clancy for 29 years of sponsorship. May he rest in peace. Tom Bouchard for taking on my case this year. My son Sean, who's sitting with me tonight and surrendered to this program 14 years ago. I appreciate the program that you work and the rest of my family. I want to thank a finance class for coming every other Sunday and facing their fears and clearing away the wreckage. And also Vincio, may he rest in peace, who taught those of us couples that argue over finances that it's not about finances, it's about communication. So thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for helping me be a better person. Thanks.
And our last birthday is also for a former secretary of the Pacific Group, Steve W., for 35 years.
All right, I get to stand tall. Hi, I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Matt for the cake and being my sponsor. I'd like to thank Clancy for 25 years of sponsorship and starting this group, for the structure and the lives that we have today. And I would like to thank the men I sponsor. You make me become a better man, and you keep me in check. And I'd love to thank God. And mostly, I want to thank all of you for giving me a life that I didn't know I could have. I love you, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
that's all the in-person birthdays. On Zoom, we have some birthdays, too. For 2 years, for Monique J. and Susie S. is her sponsor. For 3 years, Cindy S. and Julie St. J. is her sponsor. For 3 years, for Curtis S. and Sean C. is his sponsor. For 3 years, for Julie O. and Marilyn S. is her sponsor. For 11 years, for Blair P. and Yvonne S. is her sponsor. And for 16 years, for Roxanne H. and Julie St. J. is her sponsor. Okay. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cake. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to the AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. Or if you're online, if you're participating, please arrange for this with our treasurer, Lon B., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.